Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
How did life begin? For thousands of years, people believed in spontaneous generation, organisms arising from non-life without progenitor or seed. Since the time of Aristotle, support for spontaneous generation has slowly retreated to its final stronghold, spontaneous formation of the first living organism. But what does the latest science say about the prospects of natural processes satisfying the requirements for a naturalistic origin of life? I'm Eric Anderson, and joining me today for this episode is Dr. Robert Stadler, co-author of a recently published book, The Stairway to Life, An Origin of Life Reality Check. Dr. Stadler received a bachelor's degree in biomedical engineering from Case Western Reserve University, a master's in electrical engineering from MIT, and a PhD in medical engineering from the Harvard-MIT Division of Health Sciences and Technology. As a scientist in the medical device industry for over 20 years, Dr. Stadler has obtained more than 140 patents, has been elected Fellow of the American Institute of Medical and Biomedical Engineers, and has contributed to medical devices that are used by millions of patients worldwide. Welcome, Dr. Stadler.
Thank you, Eric. It's great to be here today.
So, Rob, I had the opportunity to review the manuscript, and I really found the approach that you and Dr. Changelar Attan took to this topic particularly valuable. The origin of life is an area near and dear to my heart, so I'm eager to talk with you about it today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I want to get into the book, but first, would you mind sharing how you became interested in this topic? You have an impressive background from MIT and Harvard and a lot of experience in the medical device industry. How did an engineer become interested in the origin of life?
Well, I actually think of myself as a half engineer and half scientist. At least that's how my career has gone. But both of those halves have a strong interest in how life works. And I've been keeping a close watch on the origin of life research for some time now. But the motivation, the spark to write a book actually came from my co-author, Change Tan. She's a professor of biology at the University of Missouri. And she started teaching classes about how life works by talking about how would you try to build a cell from basic chemicals. And so we started talking about that, and it kind of made sense to collaborate because I'm an engineer, and engineers like to build things and right. Specify requirements, kind of lay out what's needed. And so it was a great collaboration.
Excellent. Before we dive into the pages of the book, let's start with the cover itself. The title of the book has two important parts that I assume were no doubt chosen for a reason. First, what do you mean by the stairway to life? And second, why do we need a reality check about the origin of life?
Yeah, good question. So the goal of origin of life research is trying to find a natural process that bridges this big gap between chemistry, which is basically simple molecules, and biology, where you have a living organism, and even the simplest of cells contain highly organized and complex biomolecules and information and coordinated activity. It's quite a large gap.
Yeah.
So as we approached writing a book about that, we thought that a stairway would be a convenient metaphor to lay out the required steps to build from chemistry to biology. But to give a little spoiler alert, I guess, that it turns out, you know, as we progress through the book, that we find that a cliff is probably a better metaphor than a stairway, because most of these required steps would have to occur simultaneously in order to get the job done. And then your second question about why do we need a reality check? Well, it's incredible to me how popular media barrages us every day with hints that life started naturally.
Yeah.
Seems that not a day goes by that you don't hear about life on another planet, or how just finding water on a planet would mean that there's life, or how we have synthetic life being developed in laboratories. And it seems like the alternative, which is that natural processes can't do this, seems to be excluded up front. And so as a scientist, and I investigated this, it comes as kind of a surprise that all of this propaganda we're hearing doesn't really have much of a scientific basis. In fact, I think science discourages such a belief. Science is really good at clarifying what natural processes can do, and also helps to know what they can't do.
Mm-hmm.
And so we know enough through science to know better than to expect natural processes to start life. And that's a clear message that needs to be heard, not censored. And that's why we need a reality check.
Yeah. So when you talk about science, you're talking about the real science rather than the propaganda that we sometimes hear in the name of science.
Exactly.
Yeah, I must have clicked on something a while back on my computer, because now I get almost every day some kind of article about a naturalistic origin of life or this or that study. So I definitely understand what you mean. And I like how you frame this as a stairway, because that's helpful, but also the cliff, because everything has to happen at once. That's very helpful. So the book begins by drawing a parallel between the old belief in spontaneous generation of animals like insects or rats and the modern belief of a purely natural origin of life. How are the two related?
Yeah, well, both of them speak to natural processes being responsible for producing life out of non-life. And as you mentioned in the intro, you know, for thousands of years, people believed that life, even animals, could spontaneously generate. And it's interesting to look into that history that over thousands of years, the belief slowly retreated from larger animals to smaller and smaller animals, down through rats and then mice and then insects. And then at the beginning of the 19th century, you have Erasmus Darwin, who's the grandfather of Charles Darwin, mm-hmm. making strong arguments that microscopic life could just spontaneously generate. And that, you know, even that eventually retreated, and it retreated to what I call the final stronghold, which is the final belief here that only the very first life began spontaneously, you know, billions of years ago. And that stronghold is quite hard to defeat, but that's kind of what we're left with. So we no longer believe that, you know, larger animals or insects can generate spontaneously, because we know enough through science to know better.
Sure.
And it's kind of like, you know, a perpetual motion machine. People have tried to build those things, and now we know enough to know better than to waste our time trying to build a perpetual motion machine.
Yeah, I like that. I've used that example as well. I think that's very apt. So why then do some people continue to believe that the very first life on Earth started spontaneously?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm probably going to strike some nerves here, but I think there are two reasons why people hold on to it. And one is that you can always imagine some new approach that hasn't been considered yet, some new recipe or a new location or situation mm-hmm. that could have started life. And so it's very hard to falsify every possible situation. And the second is, you know, if you say that life could not have started through natural causes, that means you're invoking some sort of agent, intelligent agent beyond natural causes. And an atheistic worldview really can't tolerate that. They need to have a natural origin for life. And so you're kind of threatening their worldview, and they'll do whatever they can to defend that.
Right. Yeah, it reminds me of what Philip Johnson noted at one point, that the naturalistic story is the creation story of the secular intellectual, I think he called it. So yeah, definitely a big aspect there.
Exactly.
So the book then delves into Craig Venter's production of a self-replicating cell in the lab. And I think it was in 2010, he claimed to have produced the first self-replicating species that we've had on the planet whose parent is a computer, he wrote. How does this, his work, relate to the origin of life?
Well, Craig Venter certainly has some impressive accomplishments, but he's also very good at marketing and making bold claims. If it is indeed possible, as he said, that you can have a living cell created by a computer or parent of a computer, then certainly makes it seem possible that a natural process could have started life. But if you study their work, you dig into what they've done, you find out that their efforts to create a synthetic cell have borrowed extensively from existing life. Even the genome that they used in their life was about 99% copied exactly from simple bacteria. And the replication process for DNA that they used to build up their DNA, they borrowed that or conscripted it from bacteria and yeast. Everything basically that they did required living organisms. So in their experience, when you look at it closely, it's kind of contrary to their bold claims. It actually emphasizes how life only comes from life and requires intelligence. In this case, it was the intelligence of these investigators to produce it.
Yeah, that soundbite, life from a computer is really striking, but it's almost comical when you think about it. I mean, the computer was, of course, a tool that they used in this whole process, but the life certainly didn't arise from a computer.
Exactly.
Let's talk about some of these stairs on the stairway to life. We can't go through each of the required steps in the interest of time, but maybe you'd like to highlight one or two of these that you think are key challenges for a naturalistic explanation for life.
Yeah, the book actually has 12 steps. We can't get through them, I'm sure. But just to point out that I'm certain that as we continue to understand what life is and what life requires, there will be new steps added. So the problem is going to get harder as we learn more about life.
Right. And maybe some sub-steps added too, right? I mean, there's ways that those those 12 could be broken down into more.
Exactly. So maybe I could point out a few of my favorites. One of them that's commonly heard is homochirality, chirality of life, where most biomolecules have a property called chirality, where they can have a left-handed version or a right-handed version, which are not superimposable. And if you create these biological molecules outside of life, you always get a 50-50 mixture. But life itself is extremely selective, and you only see one of the two hands. Now, part that we mentioned that's hardly ever mentioned is that, you know, like DNA and RNA have sugars in them, and the sugar molecule in RNA actually has four chiral locations. So each nucleotide of RNA actually has 16 possible chiralities. Hmm. And yet in every living thing, in all of life, in every nucleotide, you get the same exact chirality, which is extraordinarily unlikely through a non-biological process. And another one that I like in the book is you need a means for repairing these biopolymers. So, for example, DNA in your body, it faces a continuous barrage of damage every day. Just sitting in water, we're all sitting in water, damages your DNA thousands of times per day. And then you have radiation, you have oxidation, you have chemical attacks. So all of life has to have specialized enzymes, specialized molecular machines that go around repairing the DNA, and they're essential for life. Now, the trick is we run into a serious chicken and egg problem here, because you can't have the enzymes without DNA, because the enzymes are encoded in the DNA.
Right.
But you also can't have the DNA without the repair mechanisms, without the enzymes. So they each depend on each other. And so how could you get that started?
Yeah, there's a real irony here. I mean, we're told by the evolutionary story that mutations, mistakes, errors, those kinds of things in DNA is what helps an organism gain new abilities and eventually turn into something else. But when we actually look under the hood and look at what's going on in living organisms, there are lots of systems, and it seems like a constant effort on the part of the organism to keep these damaging effects at bay. And, you know, that makes complete sense from an engineering standpoint, but it's a little bit harder to square with the evolutionary story.
It also speaks to the process that they envision requiring hundreds of millions of years. That amount of time is certainly very degrading toward any kind of big molecule.
Yeah, exactly. Until you have those repair mechanisms fully on board, in place, and ready to go, you're in trouble, aren't you?
Exactly, yes.
So how has the Origin of Life community approached some of these challenges that you mentioned?
Yeah, so of course, their goal in, you know, kind of metaphorical sense is they're protecting this final stronghold, you know, their foundational belief, and they have to protect that at all costs. And I kind of see their strategy as threefold. The first is to portray life as being very simple. Back in the 19th century, Ernst Haeckel was kind of a well-known scientist, but he actually called cells, quote, nothing more than a shapeless, mobile, little lump of mucus or slime, unquote. And, you know, that kind of simplification of life makes it seem easier to just start up. And, of course, the Origin of Life community today doesn't refer to cells as slime, but they do continually try to simplify what life is. And you'll find them even trying to define viroids, which are just single molecules, as living things. And so it makes it easier for them to get to life if life is simple.
Yeah.
And then the second one they do is they highlight any small progress. And this is part of the media blitz and the propaganda we hear that anything they can find, that the media grabs onto it and amplifies it to make it seem like it's quite possible. And then finally, I think this is kind of their big trump card in a sense, is that they define science as only including natural processes, excluding anything that could transcend a natural process. And they call that non-scientific. So what they're doing is essentially defining the problem, defining the way the problem runs such that their answer is the only possible answer, the only allowed possible thought to solve the problem.
Yeah. Regardless of what the evidence shows now, we know that at some point we have to stumble upon a naturalistic origin. So we've got to keep looking, and you can't draw any conclusions until we find the answer that we want, right?
Yeah, it's a powerful way to make sure you're right.
Yeah. Well, that's a pointed set of criticisms. I mean, life is anything but simple, and there's been a lot of tremendous efforts put into finding these building blocks, as you say. But even if we find those are still necessary but insufficient conditions to build life.
Exactly.
Well, unfortunately, Rob, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for being with us. If you don't mind, I'd love to have you back to share more about this incredibly important topic of the origin of life.
Thank you, Eric. I'd enjoy that very much.
You can get a copy of The Stairway to Life, an Origin of Life Reality Check, in paperback or ebook format at online retailers like Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Thank you for listening to this episode of ID the Future. If you find this podcast a valuable contribution to the public conversation about origins, please consider helping us spread the word by giving the show a 5-star review on your podcast app of choice. Until next time, for ID the Future, I'm Eric Anderson.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.